Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Scott Solomon. He is teaching professor at Bryce University in Houston. He's also a research associate at the Smithsonian Institution National Museum of Natural History. And we're talking about his new book, Becoming Martian: How Living in Space Will Change Our Bodies and Minds. Scott, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks so much, Mark. Happy to be here.
I'm so glad you wrote this book, first of all, because there's these, as you talk to other people in this book, and you did a lot of field work in this book, there are these people who are going, we really can't go to Mars ever, or at least not within our foreseeable future. And then there are other people who are like cheerleaders, let's go to Mars now. And you sort of really uncovered all the points of what we need to be doing or figuring out before we even make this decision. Was this a tough book to write? It seems like you had to do a lot of on-the-ground research.
Yeah, well, you know, any undertaking of this magnitude has its challenges. I found it a very enjoyable and satisfying process, to be honest. But yeah, you know, I really wanted to approach it with an open mind. I think it's a very polarizing topic, depending on who you speak to.
Oh, God.
You get reactions ranging from, that's a crazy idea, why would you even consider it, to, oh, yeah, that's definitely happening and happening soon, and everything in between. So I really wanted to approach this with an open mind and to, you know, explore all the possibilities, but to do so from the point of view of a scientist. You know, an evolutionary biologist, as you know, and I wanted to understand, like, what actually happens if this does come to pass? Do we know what the consequences would be of living beyond Earth?
And I want to mention, for the benefit of the audience, we cannot possibly do this book justice in one 27-minute interview, but we'll cover a couple of places. As Scott Kelly writes in your foreword to your book, long-term spaceflight takes a toll physically and psychologically. And that's sort of the basic truth that we know so far, that even the people who've gone up to Mir, to different space stations for prolonged periods of time, stuff happens to them. And let's talk about what that is. I mean, what are the physical and psychological aspects of just being up in a small contained space for a long period of time in low G?
Yeah, you're right. This is something that we actually do know a fair bit about. And, you know, I was delighted that Scott Kelly agreed to contribute the foreword. I mean, who better to hear from than somebody who has, you know, among other accomplishments, spent about a year on the International Space Station as part of the NASA Twin Study. And so, you know, he, you know, points out a lot of the things that he personally experienced. And then I kind of elaborate on what do we sort of know from the science side, and what have we even learned since the NASA Twin Study? So, you know, we could probably talk all day about it, but just I'll give you some sort of categories.
Well, first of all, let's talk about this twin, Scott and Mark Kelly's study. What an ideal situation. You have these twins, Scott and Mark Kelly, who most people know both of them, and they decided to study their body in detail while one was up in space for an extended period of time and the other remained on Earth. I think that's sort of an ideal experiment that's not going to come along too often. So what did they find out about the effects on their body?
Yeah, so it was cool because what they did, this was, you know, at the time it was the most detailed study of what happens to a human in space that had ever been done. And there have been quite a few studies since then, and a lot of what we have found has kind of, you know, basically confirmed what they found in that sort of landmark twin study. But then, you know, we've also learned more. So, you know, a lot of what it was is like basically looking at everything from how, you know, your muscles begin to weaken because, you know, they're not having to fight against gravity. The bones also become more brittle because basically bone is just responding to what your muscles doing. If your muscles aren't having to work, you know, think about your legs, right? You know, our legs are supporting our weight even if we're just standing. For an astronaut up in space, they're not having to do any of that. So the bones get more brittle, the muscles weaken. We kind of knew that already before the twin study, but what the twin study showed us is down to the level of DNA.
That's the part that scared me.
Yeah, well, that's right. And it's what we need to understand as we think about people spending more and more time in space and going deeper into space. Those changes to our DNA are going to become really really important. And then they also found things like the composition of the microbiome, right? All the bacteria and other microorganisms that live in and on our body, and we now know that many of those are really essential for human health. That changes, too, in space.
Now, also, what about heart and circulation?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the heart isn't having to work as hard to pump blood up to, you know, your head, because there is no up in space. And so, you know, it can start to get a little bit weaker. There's concerns as well about things like blood clots, right? Because one of the things that happens is the body thinks that there's too much fluid because of the way the fluid is kind of being redistributed, again, because of lower gravity. And so astronauts often come back anemic. You know, they've lost blood, including red blood cells, and that can thicken the blood and lead to a risk of blood clots as one of the serious concerns. So all of these are, you know, things that, you know, scientists at NASA and other places have been paying attention to these things for a long time. But we now know quite a bit of detail about what happens to the human body in the very specific environment of low Earth orbit, which is where all the space stations, you know, have operated and continue to operate. But, you know, as we go deeper, as we go to the moon and Mars, it actually becomes a bit different.
In what way?
Well, there's a variety of things. For one thing, you know, what we think of as being in space, you think about, you know, people kind of floating in microgravity, right? Weightlessness.
Right.
Well, you know, as we know from, you know, seeing the Apollo astronauts on the moon, there's gravity on the moon.
It's right.
Partial
right.
gravity, right? So it's about 1/6 of the gravity that we have here on Earth. We actually don't know that much about the long-term effects of partial gravity on the human body, because all we know is what happened to those Apollo astronauts. And the longest that anybody spent on the moon was about 3 days.
Hey.
So, you know, do like your muscles weaken? Do your bones become brittle? The heart, all of those things that we talked about for space, is that true as much in partial gravity? Or is it just, you know, not quite as bad, but still a concern? We don't really know. We can kind of make educated guesses, but until we actually send people there for long amounts of time, we can't be sure. And that's going to be the case for Mars as well. Mars has about 1/3 the gravity of Earth, so it's something in between the moon's gravity and Earth's gravity. But again, we have no experience with this and no data, so there's really no way to be sure.
Now, for the astronauts that have been in the space stations, have they found ways to ameliorate the situation, like to lessen the effects on muscles and the heart and circulatory system? Like exercise really
exactly.
matters.
Exactly. Yeah. So they basically what they've figured out through sort of trial and error here is that you have to do a lot more exercise than, you know, even astronauts who are, you know, typically pretty fit individuals, right? They have to do about 2 hours every day of exercise just to kind of minimize the amount of muscle atrophy and bone density loss. So it's not that it stops it, it just prevents it from getting really bad. And so that's really important. They have to do that. But again, you know, we don't know what is going to be necessary for people. Maybe you just don't have to do quite as much exercise when you're up there on Mars, but probably still something.
Well, first of all, it's even more complicated if we're heading to Mars, because there's going to be a prolonged period of weightlessness getting there. Then there's right. being there. And then hopefully yep. the first people who land on Mars will be coming back, although a lot of them talk about not wanting to come back or just giving up their life there. But that seems like it's even more complicated.
That's right. So it currently, with the technology that we have, would take you know, about 6 to 9 months to go in one direction from Earth to Mars, and about the same amount of time to come back. But it's more complicated than that, because you can't just turn around and come back, because you can only travel between Earth and Mars
right.
when those two planets are relatively close together. So by the time you've gotten there, they've separated again, and you have to wait for them to come back around in their orbits, and that takes about 2 years. So there's no way to do a round-trip mission between Earth and Mars in anything less than about 2.5 years. And it's probably going to be even longer than that. So We're talking about a long mission, much longer than any humans have ever spent continuously away from Earth. The record, by the way, is 437 days. That's the longest any single human has spent continuously in space. So we would shatter that record with the first round-trip mission to Mars.
Oh, my God. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Scott Solomon. He is teaching professor at Rice University in Houston. He's also a research associate at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. And we're talking about his new book. It's a great read. Becoming Martian: How Living in Space Will Change Our Bodies and Minds. First of all, let's talk about radiation. Like radiation in space, radiation on the moon, and especially radiation on Mars. It's a problem.
It is. Yeah. And some people, you know, kind of in the space community who are very well aware of, you know, the situation with radiation and the challenges. But there are folks who you know, would tell you that, well, yes, there's radiation. Yes, it can be problematic, but we know how to manage it. And it's true that we have learned a lot about how to manage it. But I would argue that this is not something that we can, you know, write off or overlook. I think as we go deeper into space and spend longer there, it really is going to be one of the most significant challenges. You know, radiation damages DNA. That's what it does. And that's the reason why when you go to get an X-ray at the, you know, dentist or the doctor or whatever, you put the little lead vest on, right? Because you're trying to protect your DNA. And so we saw this in the NASA twin study. There was damage to Scott Kelly's DNA that was caused by the radiation environment of space. But here's where it gets especially tricky, right? Because there's more radiation in space than there is on Earth, right? Our atmosphere shields us from a lot of it. But the other thing that shields us from radiation on Earth is the Earth's magnetic field. We've got this amazing magnetic field that surrounds us. We don't even think about it most of the time, but it's part of what makes it possible for life to exist on Earth. Once you get out past that magnetic field, and it extends pretty far into space, actually, the International Space Station is inside of the Earth's magnetic field. So those astronauts like Scott Kelly on the International Space Station, yes, they have more radiation because they're above the atmosphere, but they don't have as much as astronauts that go deeper, like to the moon or Mars. Once you get past the protection of the magnetic field, you're being exposed to substantially more radiation and kinds of radiation that aren't as big a problem here on the surface of our planet.
We should explain for the benefit of the audience of where the radiation is coming from.
Yeah, it's coming from different places. So part of it is coming from the sun, right? So, I mean, we're familiar with ultraviolet radiation. That's UV. That's why we have to wear, you know, sunscreen. But there's other types of radiation, too. So the sun is ejecting these particles that are traveling at high speed. And there's also radiation that's coming from stars in other solar systems and galaxies. And we call this galactic cosmic rays. And so these are really a very dangerous form of radiation, and they're one that, you know, we really, like I said, don't know that much about how it affects the human body, because the only humans that have ever really been exposed to that type of radiation at that intensity are the very few astronauts that have traveled to the moon, to the vicinity of the moon. And that includes, by the way, the Artemis II crew who just recently traveled around the moon. Right. One of the things that they were looking at in that mission was what happens to the DNA of a human being that is being exposed to that type of radiation.
Now, I'm going to skip around. There, you touch on so many great points in this book, and you sort of look in what we know about this. Changing from the physical to the psychological and social. The social psychological dynamics of a bunch of people cooped up in a small space is a really important thing that we need to know more about. And I love the fact that you went to the biosphere and looked at it. There are reports from the McMurdo Antarctic outpost in the wintertime. There are problems. When a small group of people are in a confined space with limited abilities to do activity, strange things happen.
That's right. And I think, you know, everybody got a little taste of this during the COVID-19 pandemic when we were cooped up, right? And yet, like, you know, most of us could still, like, step outside or open a window if you needed to, right? Those are things you don't have the option of doing when you're stuck inside a, you know, spacecraft traveling through the void of space. So, yeah, so astronauts face these real legitimate psychological and emotional challenges of being, you know, not only in a small confined space with just a small number of other people, but having the knowledge that just beyond that wall of your spacecraft is the harshest environment that you could possibly imagine. It's actually one that's difficult for our heads to wrap around how harsh that environment is, because it's unlike anything on Earth. And then also knowing how far away from home you are. That knowledge, you know, does something.
That makes me claustrophobic, really, and I don't have claustrophobia. It's like...
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, we try to understand it, and we try to, you know, do studies to kind of figure out, well, what works best? What are the best practices? How can you help people deal with that? And, you know, we do it with actual astronauts traveling into space, but then we also do it with simulations of all different sorts, right? Everything from, you know, a simulated mission to space, which could last a couple of weeks or could last a year or more. And, you know, NASA does these, but there's also groups of, you know, basically private citizens who are interested in this work and propose their own research studies and go out and carry them out. But then, as you said, you know, we can look like, well, what's the closest replicate that we have? Like, you know, the most similar, what we call analog to those conditions here on Earth. So being in an Antarctic research station the winter is, you know, kind of similar in a lot of ways. It's a harsh environment. You can't just step out and you can't just come home if you need to, at least not easily. Another example would be on a nuclear submarine, where you might have to spend months submerged and, you know, definitely can't step outside and can't just come home. So, you know, those types of situations give us some insight into the challenges. But if you think about, you know, people traveling to Mars and then perhaps living on Mars, they are going to have those types of psychological stresses, those types of emotional stresses, but, you know, ramped up to a much more extreme extent.
I love the history of biosphere that you include in this book and the things that went on there.
The Biosphere 2 experiment in Arizona, for those of us that, you know, were around in the 90s to remember it. I mean, it was a famous thing, but you know, I think a lot of people either forgot about it or aren't familiar with it. It's the most ambitious attempt that has ever taken place to try to create an enclosed environment, you know, sealed environment within which are replicas of Earth's ecosystems and the ability to grow food. And then 8 people spent 2 years hermetically sealed inside this facility. Depending on who you talk to, some people would say that it was a failure, and other people would point to the many successes that they had. I mean, they did come out alive 2 years later, right?
So, but there were some periods of time in there where things were getting dicey.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the 8 people split into 2 factions of 4 and basically wouldn't speak to one another.
Other than that, it was great.
Yeah. So, I mean, it points to the real importance of who you send and how you make sure those folks are able to, you know, not just work together, but be civil and be able to get along and, you know.
But also, in the case of Biosphere, there was a malfunction that affected the CO2 levels, right?
That's right. Yeah, they had.
And all of a sudden, everybody started getting edgy. People started acting weird. And you also write extensively about what are we going to have to bring if we were to have a colony on Mars.
Yes.
The list of things that we're going to have to bring is huge.
That's right. And, you know, people often will compare the idea of you know, settling Mars or another planet to, you know, the pioneers of previous generations, including in the American West, people who went out, you know, and brought what they needed with them and started a new life. And I think there are similarities, but at the same time, we have to recognize that any instance of humans settling new places on Earth, things that they didn't have to worry about were the fact that there's oxygen in the atmosphere, right. That your body fluids don't boil off when you step outside, and that there's, like, you know, soil and water and even microorganisms that we know are necessary to keep our bodies healthy and to help us grow food, right? So those are all things that we tend to take for granted, and that people who are trying to live on other planets won't be able to take for granted. They'll have to bring those things. They'll have to plan ahead, bring them with enough redundancy that if something doesn't work, or they forgot it, or that it fails for whatever reason, that it's not catastrophic.
There's obviously a section of your book that a lot of people are going to be fascinated by, but it was a lot more serious, is having children on Mars. The quick answer is yes, people will probably have sex on and there's a rumor that Mark Lee and Jan Davis, is it, that they may have already had sex in space?
Well, this is one of those topics that, and whenever you start talking about human space flight, it's one of the topics that inevitably comes up, is that, you know, basically people want to know, has anyone ever had sex in space? And as far as we know,
well,
the answer is no.
NASA wouldn't admit it anyways.
That's right. The speculation in the case of the couple that you're talking about is because it's the only instance in which NASA or any government space agency knowingly sent a married couple up to space at the same time. And so in this case, they were on the space shuttle together for, I forget how long their mission is, but shuttle missions were usually, you know, around a week and a half or so. So it's not like a very long mission, but, you know, they were up there and, you know, of course everybody asked about this afterwards, and they didn't say anything about it. NASA wouldn't say anything about it. Of course, people speculate, but,
we're going to run out of time, but I got to talk about this. That's not the big issue, is whether you can have sex. The big issue is giving birth,
exactly.
Embryonic development in low G or no G. And that's problematic. We don't know anything about that, or we know very little.
Yes. And I would say it's everything from conception all the way through childbirth, but not only that, also child development, right?
Right.
Everything that we know about what happens to the human body in space is what we know from studying healthy adults. We know next to nothing about how a child's body would be affected by being in a different gravity environment, or by being exposed to those types and levels of radiation. The psychological effects that we were talking about for, you know, healthy adults, how would they affect children? Those are essential things for us to know if we are ever going to be serious about not just visiting Mars and other planets, but actually setting up civilization there.
And lastly, I want to talk about terraforming, because that's one of those things some people throw out, is that's the solution. Okay, we can't solve some of these big problems, but what if we just terraform Mars? We don't have the technology anywhere near that now, do we?
Yeah, I mean, this idea, it comes initially from science fiction, right?
Let's
just modify the environment on Mars to make it like Earth, and then all these problems that we're talking about, you know, might go away. I would say that, you know, the idea of terraforming, there was a time in which it really was being taken seriously by scientists, you know, including folks like Carl Sagan, who was arguing for this initially for Venus and then Mars. The problem is that the more that we learn about what those planets like Mars are like, the more we realize how very challenging it would be to actually modify it in ways that would make it anything really Earth-like, in ways that would be practical to us. The ability to just walk around outside without a spacesuit and, you know, an oxygen tank. That's a long ways off. And the worst thing, in my opinion, is even if you could do it, it would only be temporary. Because without getting into too much detail about planetary science, basically any atmosphere that Mars has gets constantly stripped
right.
away by
right.
what the sun is doing to Mars with the solar wind. And so, you know, you really can't fix it in any long-term permanent way. So that's probably not going to be the way that we're going to be able to live on Mars. We're going to have to build habitats that are going to allow us to have environments inside of them that are suitable for people to live and for us to grow plants for food and all of that. But the planet itself is probably not going to be able to be changed in a meaningful enough way for us to be able to live there the way we live here.
Now, what that means, and you write about this, is that we're going to have to be living likely underground, under the surface of either the moon or Mars. And think about that, about living. You don't have a window. It's not like those in the science fiction movies. It's not like you're going to have windows where you can look out even. You're going to be underground on a planet you can't go outside on.
Yeah, that's right. Because, you know, that's the easiest way to protect yourself from the radiation, right?
Right.
And also the fact that there are meteorites that strike Mars the way they strike Earth, but without having a thick atmosphere, they're going to be coming in at you know, full speed. You don't want those striking your beautiful glass dome. So I think we're talking about going, you know, all the way to Mars and then basically living underground, which to me takes a lot of the romance and excitement out of it. But there might still be some people that would sign up for that kind of a mission.
Yeah, by the end of your book, I was going like, okay, maybe way after I'm dead. But there's so much technology we need to develop, and there's so much about the human body in space we still have to learn, especially about embryonic development and conception. That stuff, I think, is we don't know crap about.
Well, we do need to learn a lot more before I think it would be responsible for us to start loading up people that are planning to go and start families there, right? And that's really one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, is to make sure that people really truly understand what we're talking about.
Yeah,
talking
exactly.
About creating a settlement or a city on Mars, right? Or the same is true of the moon. Like, these are things that sound great, and maybe someday we will be there. And I even argue in the book that it might even really be necessary for us to do that.
Yeah, unfortunately.
To protect us.
Yeah, exactly, unfortunately.
To preserve life. But I don't think we're there yet.
We're out of time. This is a great book. My guest tonight is Scott Solomon. He's a teaching professor at Rice University in Houston. He's also a research associate at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. And his book is Becoming Martian: How Living in Space Will Change Our Bodies and Minds. Scott, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Mark. This has been fun.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.